Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, God, I've been called by a million names all my life. I don't want a name. I'm better off with a grunt or a groan for a name.
Next Wednesday, August 12th, our Inside the Classics series continues with a celebration of one of the most acclaimed and controversial films ever made, Bernardo Bertolucci's Last Tango in Paris. Then...
All right, I'm going to give you a choice. You can either have the money and the hammer, or you can walk out of here. You can't have both. What do you want?
I just want to get out of here.
On Wednesday, August 19th, the next installment of the New Classics series offers an in-depth exploration of Martin Scorsese's Casino. Exclusively on Movie Geeks United.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Pleasure to bring you the show tonight. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome, guys. Whether you're listening live or on replay, we appreciate your listenership very much. And we've got a great, packed, exciting... tonight's show is about passion, I think. That's the theme of tonight's show.
Definitely.
We're starting out with a great conversation we have with Armand Asante. And to give you an idea of how... wonderfully passionate our conversation with him was, and Armand Asante was, we were slated for 15 minutes with him, and we went about 35 minutes.
Yeah,
it was
wonderful.
Yeah, he is one of our great outstanding guests, and a little later in the show we'll bringing on Annette Baron. She's the director of a new documentary called Beer Wars, and if you're like us, you like beer.
Yeah. Or any alcohol, for that matter.
Yes. And I'm telling you, this is actually a great movie, and I can't wait to get in depth with her about the themes of this movie, because they run a little deeper than just the second most popular beverage on the planet. You got to look under the foam, and you get to the real substance of the movie. And
there you go.
Cool. And then, sadly, yesterday, one of the great friends of our show, Blake Snyder, passed on, and we just received word this afternoon about that, and so we put together a series of clips from our two interviews with Blake, and we're going to pay tribute to him tonight. Just a wonderful man.
One of the greats. Very nice, very good-hearted person, and we really enjoyed having him on, and we're hoping to have him on again. Just to talk about what's coming out, where he's at, what he does for everyone. I mean, this guy was really just a real class act.
All the way. So I'm sure a lot of Blake's fans will be tuning in a little bit later for that segment, and feel free to call into the show at 718-508-9477 or put your comments in the chat room, whatever you'd like, all the way through any of the guests that we're talking to tonight. Feel free to do that and participate.
Yes.
All right, we ready for this first interview?
Yes, we are.
Let's do this. Armand Asante. What words come to mind when you think of Armand Asante, Jerry?
Badass. I won't lie to you, man. No. He, before, a couple of years before Warren Beatty played Bugsy, I would have to say, like, his little part in The Marrying Man, I mean, the highlight of the movie, but he plays Bugsy Siegel. Just one of those great, like, really small roles, but leaves a lasting impression. But he's been in a lot of movies. a lot of great movies that I like, The Mambo Kings. You know, he's just a really good actor. Private Benjamin I grew up with, and Prophecy. So he's been all over the place, a lot of different kind of movies, too, a lot of different kind of roles, and he's a fascinating actor.
Q&A.
Q&A is one of the best, I think. Personally.
One of the great, definitely one of the great 80s Lumet films.
Yeah.
Gotti.
Gotti, he's the quintessential. He's like who I think of as John Gotti, so, I mean, he's great.
Yeah, we talk about all of that, including his new film, The Line, co-starring Andy Garcia and Ray Liotta. We've talked about the film a little bit earlier, an earlier show with a screenwriter. There was a closing film this past weekend of the New York Latino International Film Fest, and you'll be seeing it making the rounds more and more as the weeks and months pass. It's a very good film, and he's very passionate about that project as well. And as he is with so many topics that we discuss in this conversation. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Armando Sante.
I read something interesting about you, and I don't know if it's an erroneous quote or not, but I believe that music was your first passion, and actually you said that acting was a very arduous art form for you to get into. Why was that the case?
I think because music, as a boy... It just came intuitively very, very easy to me. When I started to seriously act in the theater, it was not what I would call necessarily as simple a pursuit as I thought it would be, because I had a great instinct for acting, but I worked for 10 years in the theater before I made a film. And, I mean, I think acting, unlike music is a very liberating experience, and I think acting... is psychologically a very consuming endeavor. So, I mean, for me, music was just incredibly liberating, and I found that acting, although I love storytelling, but it certainly is not nearly as liberating as music. And because of the complexity of different behavioral, you know, issues and patterns you have to explore, it's one of the most challenging things that I found to do in my life, certainly.
I think I spoke to, or we spoke to, I believe it was Joe Pantoliano, who said that at the beginning of his career, acting was very difficult for him and arduous, as you're describing, because he had the need to throw in everything but the kitchen sink, to kind of overanalyze. But as time went on and his career advanced, he became a much more efficient actor, and he learned how to pick his battles with his characters. Does that speak to you at all?
Very much, and essentially, I mean, the task is really a part of storytelling, and I mean, the process of developing anything is just an absolute joy, as long as you love to tell stories and want to investigate stories with people, you know, and mm-hmm. I predicate a lot of my life and the great experiences that I've had really to do with people. I mean, the beauty of acting is that you are always in relationships.
Right.
And it's very powerful in that if you're working in a creative relationship, it's not necessarily as emotionally innovating as a love relationship.
Yeah.
It's just a creative relationship.
Even so, I want to ask you about some of those creative relationships. I know that Jerry and I both had some questions about movies as well.
Quick question about, just because we're talking about the acting, I just want to know, do you still look at it as a blessing and a curse? Because at one time you were quoted, as a profession, you don't recommend it at all. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I say that only to novices that in a way have a very... Pollyannic view of the life of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is one of the most precipitous professions one could ever attempt to be part of, short of being a professional athlete. I mean, it is a highly unpredictable circumstance.
Right.
And I think if you have the fortitude to live with that kind of insecurity and know within your heart the reasons you do it, I think it can have tremendous upside, both you know, creatively and in some cases even monetarily. But the point is that it's a very, very it's a large choice to make.
Yeah.
And I know even when I was a student, I was in school with doctors and psychologists and athletes and people that never even dreamt about being actors, but they wanted the experience of being in a situation where they really had to open up and reveal themselves. And they wanted to, in a sense, use that to actually build their own self-esteem.
Right.
So I never have ever underestimated the importance of theater and the importance of theater as a community effort, because it is one of the most important things for people, number one, to learn how to communicate, to articulate, and also to express themselves and actually understand that they're okay within themselves, within the world. So, I mean, in that sense, I think it's very, very underestimated of how important it is for people from all different pursuits in life. I honestly think the theater should be made mandatory in all schools. And the reason I say that is because it forces the individual to actually enter the arena and actually be openly criticized for being who he is, what he is, and everything he stands for. And I think that is probably one of the most honest, naked, and if you will, moral positions that people can be put in. And I think it actually can build a person's self-esteem and their own values by being put in the arena with their own colleagues and comrades who not necessarily may judge them, but will force them to confront themselves. That in itself can build human values. So I really think it's a very important part of our lives that often gets shoved aside. And in fact, the more and more we've become digitalized in every aspect of our lives right now, the theater has gotten less and less important. And I think that that's becoming a smaller issue in our lives, when in fact it should become a greater pursuit.
I think you're.
Does that make any sense? I don't know.
No,
it does.
Because I just want to. I think what you're saying, because you use the word naked, I think we have forgotten as a people to what it's like to live without a net. We have the security, and we need to get rid of that security.
Very well put.
We really need to be naked in that sense. Because it's something I think about a lot. We need to get rid of the safety net, and it could make all the difference. Especially if you're talking about schools, I couldn't think of a better time period to do it.
Yeah. And I just remember that as a kid, being in with people who were much older than I am, but they wanted that in a way test of being able to put themselves in an arena and actually be openly picked apart. And I really believe it can build not just esteem, but build one's own confidence and one's own values, you know.
And it is about self-discovery, and it's also about empathizing with others, which I think is something that's badly needed.
It's so huge. It's a huge issue.
It is.
I see it especially among young people.
Yes.
I mean, the fragility of a young person's mind and psyche at that time in their lives is monumental, and if they don't have that esteem, and because the public school system, the educational system today is so huge, so overwrought with lack of focus, because teachers are stressed beyond hope. I mean, it's pathetic what goes on in public schools today. And the point is that if they don't get that kind of attention, not necessarily love, but that kind of attention and awareness, it's not serving a young person at all, you know.
Right. Well, speaking of teachers, when I look at some of the great directors that you've worked with, I always associate them with great teachers, like Lou Metz or Frankenheimer or Ridley Scott, and I'm wondering how directors like that challenge you and kind of help you bring out your full potential.
You know, it's amazing, but what I've always believed about New York per se and places like New York and London is that there's always been great acting pools that came out of New York and London, and people have always said, "Oh, look at the actors we produced in the 40s, 50s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever." But the point is that the reason we had great actors that came out of New York is that we had great teachers, and that is never, it's not brought up enough. But in fact, if you go back to the early stages, Sidney Lumet, for example, his uncle was Jacob Adler, who was with the Yiddish theater, who then, you know, emigrated to the group theater. You have people like Stella Adler that went back to Moscow with Clifford Odets. They studied the Stanislavski's The Moscow Art Theater. They built, in other words, the American theater. The American theater was built by teachers.
Yeah.
And when you're with people like Sidney Lumet or Frankenheimer, who was a different school altogether because he was the school of hard knocks, Ridley Scott was just a photography genius as a boy. He was a genius photographer as a kid. So you have the three different people there. But like Sidney Lumet is a true intellectual. Frankenheimer was a bit of an intellectual himself, but he actually was a filmmaker that actually failed and succeeded constantly because of the tremendous risks that he put himself at with film. But the point is that all those men have a seedling of teaching genius within them. But in fact, I mean, in America and London, what gave birth to great actors in the acting community was the phenomenal teaching energy that existed in these communities. And, you know, I mean, I know there's great teachers around today as well, but I mean, when I was a young actor, I mean, you always knew that there were mentors such as Lee Strasberg, Uta Hagen, Sanford Meisner, Mira Rostova, whom I studied with for 25 years. I mean, there were legends around that you could go to actually, you know, listen to and watch and observe. And the point is that you cannot underestimate the energy of those people and what they gave and what they fostered. They are the, if you will, they are the what's the godparents, if you will, of so many actors. And you only have to go back and look in their bios to find out just how influential, say, 10, 20, 30 people were to the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've nurtured the greatest actors we've had the past 30, 40 years or
yeah.
beyond. Yeah. Tell me about, Jerry, actually, you had a question about some of the roles that Mr. Sante.
You have played some of the most iconic roles in your career. You've played Bugsy Siegel. You played Mike Hammer, and you and I just want to know what, and John Gotti, probably the quintessential John Gotti performance, as far as I'm concerned. What I think of when I think of Gotti, that's what I think of. That
thank
movie
you very
that you
much.
Made. I really like that movie. We all liked that movie, actually, my family. We thought it was very well done and very accurate.
Makes you think. Makes you think about the people in your life, and I think of Neil. And if he was sitting there right now, what he'd say to me, he'd say, John, what's it about? What's life about? You don't go through it as a man's man. He said, suck it up. Take the fall. Do the time. That's made you who you are. That makes you what you are. How long have we been around this thing of ours? This goes in Austria. 120 years. And what's it about? It's about the rules. Parameters. When you take the beating for the friend, you don't run, you don't lay down, you don't betray who you are, what you are.
Self-esteem.
Self-esteem is basic. You pick it up in the street. That goes with the street. You got to remember Angie here. I love this guy. I loved him. And he was stupid. He never listened to me. He always wanted the goddamn dope money. He never rolled. You know that? He never rolled. My brother Gene, Joey DeMig, they don't roll. They're doing 1,000 years now. They don't roll. They don't rat white. That's the rule. You don't break. You don't rat. Basic rules. Gives you a little power, right? Not the kind of power these feds have. God forbid, right? God forbid we pull their chain in public. They fucking dress better than them. They take it personal. Like it's a fucking vendetta. Right? They're supposed to act better than the rest of us. Just want me to be something I wasn't even born to be.
And I just want to know, because you're watching recently like American Gangster and also Hoffa, what attracts you to this tough guy persona?
You know what? I tell you something. I didn't. It's like I entered the back door backwards. I don't know. The thing is, I don't know. I mean, I was basically, as a young person, I was quite not even into that persona or those kind of characters. If you go back and look at my earlier films, but in fact. When I did start to be asked to play roles like Mike Hamlin stuff, it just, the amount of material that came my way was quite shocking in that genre.
Right.
And actually some of the better scripts I got were of that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I was around a long time before I even did a film like Q&A. I was around forever. I was 39 years old when I did Q&A.
Right.
You know, and then Gotti, I think I was 46. I mean, those roles came to me much later, but in fact, I think it was just because the material, if you look at the scripts, they're phenomenal. I mean, the Q&A was written by Edwin Torres, who was the former Supreme Court Justice of Manhattan, and it was recrafted by Sidney Lumet. Gotti was written by Steve Shagan and Vincent Patrick, two of the best writers that ever were in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying the material that I was given, Mike Hammer was written by Mickey Spillane,
mm-hmm.
and then recrafted by Larry Cohen. But the point is, the material I was given was superb.
Right.
And I predicate most of anything I do, and believe me, I've done my share of clunkers, but the point is that script to me is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're working with writers of that kind of caliber, I mean, it's just a dream. It's a dream come true. And if you go back, even if you go back to early Hollywood in the last 50 years, look at any of the great genre gangster films. They're beautifully written films.
They are, absolutely.
You cannot ever underestimate the writing. In that there'd be many, many actors who could succeed in those films because the writing is so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the characters are so rich. I mean,
yeah, they are.
These characters that Jerry mentioned, I mean, there's so much to absorb yourself in with these guys.
It was a fabulous circumstance to do that script with Sidney Lumet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, to me, script is ironclad. I mean, it's what drives me. It's what I look for. And the truth is, if I told you how many scripts I have to read through to get to one that I even want to remotely gamble on, it's unbelievable. I mean, you cannot believe the amount of material you have to pour through
right.
to find something and say, wow, this guy hit this right on the nose, you know?
Speaking of rich and surprising characters, your character in The Line definitely is a surprising turn, and I'm wondering how the project came to you.
It came totally out of the blue. Arliss Fraser contacted me about it, and when I read it, and what attracted me to The Line is that basically almost all the characters in the film are playing a role. It's a very interesting film. It's about deep cover operatives who are actually trying to move in this very murky, dark, really brutal world effectively. And I thought it was very intelligently written. I thought it was a very bleak, unromanticized look at those kind of men that go into that kind of world with certain expectations and have them completely shattered.
Yeah.
This is happening to a lot of young men today that are in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, this is a... You know, the real reality of that kind of world is not unlike the reality of what's happening now in Afghanistan. I mean, it is brutal. And the thing is that what I liked about the script is that it explored in a way the emotional desolation of a choice that somehow men in their own macho way romanticize.
Yeah.
And if you look at all the characters in that, they're all incredibly disillusioned men.
Yes.
They're shattered. They're all shattered
right.
men. And I thought it was an interesting piece of writing. I know there's R. Ellis Frazier is the son of a U.S. Army general. So I think Frazier has a very keen insight into this world. It's not something that's just he's writing off the top of his head. He really has been around that world.
Mm-hmm.
And
we had him on the show, and he...
Did he open up about that at all?
He did. He talked a little bit about that. He also talked about loving you. So he's crazy about you, as we all are.
Yeah, we are.
Thank you, Roma.
It's a great film, and it does stand out because it is about something, and it's eye-opening and it's intelligent. And all you have to do is see the cast that was assembled to know that this is a quality piece of work. What a cast.
Yeah, it's a beautiful cast, and it was a great privilege to be with everybody. And I just thought there was a vulnerability to the writing that you don't usually see in films that, this could be done a completely different way, too, but I think because of the sensitivity of the people involved in it, it becomes a more vulnerable story.
Yeah. Do you have a Take the Line, for instance, or another project if you'd like? Is there a moment that you can think of, a kind of aha moment when you know that you have that character?
Well, I mean, certainly in film, every now and then you might be able to tap into something that you didn't know about, a certain resonance maybe you found.
Yeah.
And that certainly is a beautiful experience. The thing I'm inclined, the one thing that actors, as you go through your life as an actor, the one thing you want is to be evoked. Because basically the more you work at acting, you know that you have a certain amount of responsibility. You have to carry a role. That comes with the territory. That's your job. But the point is that you scream inside to be evoked by some voice that speaks to you, whether it's a director or even the tiniest piece of direction that just taps something inside of you that you didn't know was that secretive or unexplored.
Yeah.
And when somebody can give you that, to go into something within yourself that's a voice within yourself that's not been explored, even for a moment, it's very beautiful because you're experiencing a vulnerability about yourself that you didn't know was there. And that is the thing I think all genuine actors inside are screaming for and do not get enough of. Because in the creative world we're in today, things are moving so fast and at such lightning speed that more often than not, you don't find that experience. And you hear of certain directors like Mike Lee and some directors that'll work on a project for 6 months. It's because they want to get to that stuff.
Right.
And more often than not, even the speed at which they finally have to work anyway, they never get to the stuff anyway. But, they are grappling with the process purposely because they want to get that stuff, and that's the hardest stuff to get.
It's that moment of transcendence that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, then that's what all actors dream about, but again, it certainly helps to be with someone who's aware enough to be able to tap into that transcendence, and that takes a big head and a patient head and also somebody who's tremendous soul and tremendous observance about life.
Yes.
I always am a little disillusioned that in Hollywood generally they're knocking guys out of the loop once they're in their 40s and 50s, when in fact, if you go back into the history of Hollywood and look at the directors like John Ford, John Huston, Howard Hawks, all these guys, including people like Frankenheimer, they hit their stride in their 50s and 60s.
That's right.
They really hit their stride because, in fact, it takes a lifetime to be able to synthesize a moment.
But the NBA is running the studios don't understand that. Those guys in their 20s don't understand that.
Yeah, that life itself, the experience of life, to be able to synthesize a moment to say, we don't need this, this, and this. What we need is that light in the corner with that man sitting in the chair over there. And that's the whole fucking, that's the whole proscenium.
Yeah.
And the point is that that's the synthesis of life experience. And that I think is what makes, you know, the film world and the theater world so interesting. To me, it's all about how much a person has lived.
That's just it. And what do they want to say? And a lot of times the younger directors, they don't know. They don't know what they want to say.
Yeah, what if a 20-year-old or a 20, you know, you don't have the experience yet, really, till you're in your 40s, 50s.
Yeah. There's very few that you meet that have a special intuition or gift, very, very rarely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I shot a film in Romania 2 years ago called California Dream, and I worked with this young Romanian director who sadly was killed right after we made the film. And he was 27 years old, and he was a genius.
He was killed?
He was killed right after we made the film.
That film got the best review I've read in the New York Times, I think it came out finally in this country earlier this year.
Yeah.
That film got a superb review. Oh, God.
Yeah. It was very sad, but that kid had genius, and it was so rare. But I knew him for quite a while, and when we finally made the film, you know, the film was made for nothing in Romania, but the point is that his vast understanding of human nature for such a young person was so rare, I mean, just really rare, that was one of the few times I worked with a young person that I thought, this kid's got it in spades.
Right.
But, you know, it's just a thing. But in answer to your question, I mean, it is an issue. It always disturbs me that it's sometimes a lifetime of experience, or those are the people that can really evoke those transcendent moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the line is the closing night film of the New York International Latino Film Festival. And before I let you go, let me ask you about the film festival experience and your thoughts on the value of film festivals.
Well, you know, last October I was given the privilege of being the president of the jury at Moldau East in Ukraine, which is the International Film Festival of Ukraine, and I watched 68 films in 1 week from all over the world. 40 of them were medium films, about 30 of them, no, 40 of them were medium, about 10 were shorts and 10 were features. But the point is that the relevance of the film festival itself is that it's a cultural platform where the international community really finally has a voice. And what I was really, really taken with, especially over in that part of the world, is that the films that I voted for the most were coming out of Afghanistan, Iran, Serbia, Croatia, Russia, because the issues that people, one of the films was actually a Muslim film that came out of I believe, Serbia. But the point is that the issues that they were grappling with were so critical,
mm-hmm.
were so important, were so urgent and current that a Hollywood film at that festival would have withdrawn itself because it would have no proscenium. These films were about really important human issues that were, I mean, tremendously at stake. You know, and the film that I remember voting for was a young girl named Hana Makhbalbouf from Iran and Afghanistan in a film called Buddha Collapse from Shame about the children in Afghanistan that are manipulated by the Taliban. Absolutely shocking, terrifying film, all performed by three-year-old kids that she directed. And, I mean, completely Oscar-worthy. But the point is that the purpose of a film festival is the cultural relevance of the voices within it. You know, you have a very good film festival at Lincoln Center, the Human Rights Film Festival. Some of the films that come out of that festival are just mind-blowing. And I'm not knocking, you know, the more commercial festivals such as Cannes and the big festivals that we have here in Toronto, whatever. I'm not at all, but I'm just saying that the power of the film festival around the world, when you see them coming from places where there is no voice, where you have completely unobserved talent, when they finally get that moment and they get that platform and they take it, it's mind-blowing.
Well,
It's just a mind-blowing experience because you realize, my God, I didn't know that there were so many incredible, relevant stories that will never, ever be seen in a theater because no distributor is going to risk whether or not they're going to get an audience. The only miracle we have today is YouTube and the fact that it may go to a DVD and get a global audience.
Yeah. I mean,
because most of those films that I saw will never be seen.
And that's a shame because they're films that the makers feel a tremendous urge to make.
Yeah.
They have to be made and they have to be seen too. And I think that these festivals are most valuable for those kinds of films.
I'm still waiting for California Dreaming. I mean, I've just heard nothing but great things about this film, and it's sadly something that's not going to be,
Yeah, and oddly enough, it actually did well in Europe for what it was, and it could have run here, but they were afraid to distribute it. But again, I think the relevance of the film festival in general that I've experienced is that it gives a voice to people that will probably be never heard again. And the beauty of it is that it also shows in film the imagination that people have. It's just staggering what the medium is capable of. So, I mean, to me, I mean, there, and I'm not saying, by the way, that there should be a film festival in every town in America, but I do believe that the ones that I've attended, I mean, have incredible, to me, they will always be unforgettable experiences because of what I was exposed to.
Well, let me tell you, we get so excited and so passionate about discussing this art form that we love so much, like we've done with you tonight. We can talk to you forever, let me tell you.
We could, we really could.
Well, we're crazy about you. I told everyone that, you know, I'm speaking to Armand Asante tonight, and everybody just went crazy. They all love you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Appreciate your time so much.
It was a great, great pleasure for me as well. And anytime you want to rap, man, call me up. I'll be happy to talk to you.
All right, buddy. Let's do it.
All right.
Hey, wonderful. Thank you.
Bye-bye, sir.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. There you have it. Armand Asante. The new film is called The Line. It co-stars Andy Garcia and Ray Liotta. And just a great cast.
Yeah.
Top to bottom on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be seeing in the next weeks or months, following weeks and months, it just closed the New York International Latino Film Festival. Great conversation, great guy.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Really good.
And it's obvious that he's very passionate, as we are, about film. But now it's time to talk about our other great passion in life, and that's beer.
There you go. Let's do it. Let's go for it, man.
Yeah. What a segue.
Jason wants to talk to Armand.
Well, good. He'll have a chance to someday if he plays his cards right. Jerry, did you know that beer is the second most popular beverage behind tea?
Behind tea? Okay, I did not
know. Tea is the most popular beverage.
I didn't know that. Okay.
You ask anyone, and they'll think the Coke is the most popular beverage.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Tea. I had no idea.
But beer is second, and I can believe that.
Oh, I can, yeah.
And you'll discover a lot of eye-opening facts about beer, just like that one, in director Annette Behrens' new documentary, Beer Wars, which releases on DVD September 22nd. But you'll also find out so much more, too, because this energetically paced and endlessly insightful film also speaks to the seduction of advertising and its ability to inform cultural tastes. It speaks to the American dream and the inspirational power of the entrepreneurial spirit, and the corporations who seek to crush that spirit. It is a really fantastic film that I can't wait for everyone out there to check out. And tonight we're pleased to welcome the director of Beer Wars, Miss Annette Behrens. Miss Behrens, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I enjoyed your film very much, and I was struck by reading your bio, the history that you have, which includes the film business, but it seems to me by reading about you that you always had a kind of entrepreneurial spirit yourself, and I'm wondering where that came from, where that started for you.
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I grew up wanting to be president. I think you may have seen that in the film. And I wanted to be president of a big company. And I got my fantasy job, corporate job, and I realized very quickly that if I wanted to be that, it just was never going to happen. Not because I couldn't, but because there was way too much politics and way too much BS for me to continue and kiss people's asses. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can say yes. The women on this show.
And so I just realized that, you know, I wanted to do something on my own. And since I've been 27 years old, I've worked for myself. And it's been great. Although releasing an independent film in this day and age is a whole other story. But
yes, it is.
Still, I wouldn't want it any other way.
Yeah.
Yes, I've had the entrepreneurial bent. I also grew up in a family where my father worked in corporate life, but then also had his own businesses. And so I think I kind of grew up a little mixed up maybe, but certainly by the time I was, quote, a grown-up, and I say that in quotes because I'm not sure I ever want to be a grown-up, but I decided that for me at least, I didn't want to be a corporate person who was following somebody else's vision.
Yeah. So when did films come into play for you? Were you always inspired by films? Because you have a really impressive producing career prior to Beer Wars.
Yeah, you know what? I wish, too, that I could say, oh, you know, I went to film school, and this was my fantasy and my dream, and I grew up with my family going to drive-ins and, you know, watching movies, but that would be a total lie, although a good one, I think. But for me, it was just, yes, I always loved movies. I don't know that I thought growing up that I would ever make them. And when I moved to Los Angeles to make movies, I ended up in the television business where we made what are called Disease of the Week movies.
Sure.
On Women in Jeopardy movies, where the script was pretty much, it was the same movie, just different names, different characters, and different disease. And so that was kind of fun, but certainly wasn't as creative as literally taking something like a documentary and starting from scratch with no script.
Yeah. But did you go from your producing work to Mike's Hard Lemonade? Was that the trajectory?
You know what? How much time do we have? About 6 hours? My career, I actually have had 6 careers. So I've never done anything in a straight line, nor have I ever taken kind of the easy way out. You know, if those two roads are meeting in the woods, I'm going on the one that's more complex. And from the film business, I actually had an internet company during the boom and bust of the internet. And then I went to run Mike's Hard Lemonade. So not a straight line at all. And I think the one thing that all of the things that I've ever done have had in common is that they all involve two things. A, being good with people, and the other being able to have a vision and to actually execute.
And I take it that that's what inspired you or turned you on by the idea of running Mike's Hard Lemonade. Because, first of all, you're allergic to beer. Are you allergic to alcohol in general or just
I'm
beer?
I'm allergic to alcohol, actually. When I was in graduate school, I used to win drinking contests until one night I came home and had to go to the hospital.
Oh, man.
And that was the end of my drinking career.
Wow.
So the great thing about running Mike's Hard Lemonade, I mean, I kind of, I once heard, and I don't know if this is true, that the director of marketing for Haagen-Dazs was a diabetic. But I kind of felt like, you know, it was the one thing that I did not have to fight with the owner of the company about. We disagreed pretty much about everything, but we could never disagree about what the product tasted like. Because I had no idea.
But what lessons did you take from that experience at Mike's Hard Lemonade that have followed through in your future endeavors?
You know, Mike's Hard Lemonade is a very interesting company. I actually got into it through a friend of mine who started it and who has become very successful through owning it. It's probably one of the biggest success stories in the beer industry in the last 20 years. Most people don't know how successful it is, and he probably wants to keep it that way, so I won't harp on that. But the lessons of Mike's are that here was an entrepreneur who came up with an idea. Everyone told him it was crazy. He came up with something where he was fighting against every major beer company and liquor company out there, and yet he came in and started a new category. And so it shows you that sometimes if you kind of take that road less traveled and you find something that connects with consumers just at the right time, and you can find that path directly to them without advertising, because the first 10 million cases were sold without a stitch of advertising, which is unheard of.
That is. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was just this wild success story that took off. So I did not launch the company. I can't take credit for that, but I came on board pretty quickly after it went national and took it to that next level. And it was an amazing experience. I mean, it's an amazing brand. You know, I love brands. I love marketing, not so much advertising as much as just marketing, is finding something that consumers can really grasp onto and that have that thing that we talk about even in the movie business, you know, that emotional connection. And what I saw, because I couldn't drink Mike's, I had to do a lot of focus groups and go out and talk to consumers because I had no personal connection to it, right? I didn't know what it tasted like. I didn't even know why somebody would buy it. It just wasn't something that was ever in my fridge, certainly, because I couldn't consume it. And so I loved being in focus groups and talking to consumers, whether it was on an airplane. I mean, the flight attendants, I used to fly a lot, and so the flight attendants would see something with a Mike's logo on it, and they would rush over to me and tell me how much they loved it or what it meant to them. That was a pretty cool thing to see a brand connect with people that way. And so I learned a lot about how important it is to literally find that connection to people and walk that fine line between getting too big and being too small. And I think it's kind of an interesting parallel to even the movie business, where you have these independent films who want to seem independent and yet sometimes have a studio or someone behind them. Mm-hmm. And there's that fine line of like not wanting to cross it because you want people to, quote, discover you. And that's what Mike's was. Mike's was a discovery brand.
You know, and it struck me the parallels to the film business as I was watching your film. Mm-hmm. Because obviously there are different cases, but even so, I was thinking about the independent filmmakers who maintain their own special, unique voice. They hit a niche, they get brought on to in the big boys' room, and they start making movies with bigger budgets and less personality, less distinction. And it seemed to me, watching the film, that's kind of what the corporations are, the beer that they manufacture, compared to the homemade breweries, the ones fighting to survive. So I think that's a valuable parallel there. You found that as well?
Well, I think there are a lot of parallels between the two industries, but I think you're absolutely right. I think what happens is, in order, you know, what happens in every industry is when you want to reach, quote, a mass market, so not a specific niche, but lots and lots of people, millions of people, it's tough to stay special, and it's tough to stay, use the word independent or craft-like or anything else, because at some point, scale, just having to get bigger, forces you to change whether it's your production methods, and sometimes it forces you to become more homogenized, and I'm not talking about milk. I'm talking about just becoming more of what we think of as mass. I mean, in the movie industry, you know, that usually means, you know, something happens in Act 1, we meet the characters, in Act 2 there's a crisis, in Act 3 it gets solved. It becomes a formula.
Right.
And I think that happens a lot, you know, whether it's in the beer business, you know, appeal to as many people as possible, don't offend anyone, as it does in film.
Mm-hmm. So why did you choose to make to Beer Wars? Where did that inspiration come?
I think sometimes temporary insanity. because looking back, you kind of say, really, why did I do it? But I had left Mike's Hard Lemonade. I was taking a break. It was pretty exhausting, all the travel I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally got an invitation in the mail to the annual beer industry convention. I was still on the mailing list. And I don't know, I just had this idea of, gee, has anyone ever made a film on the inside of the beer industry? You know, because the reason I really made the film is I personally love to watch films that take you behind, not so much just behind the scenes, because it's not a Hollywood thing, but just take you and show you a world that you wouldn't ordinarily see. You know, it's kind of like, I think I know, but I really don't. And I knew that because I had access to that world, and because I was an insider, that I could probably take people further than any other filmmaker could. And so I did a quick research, couldn't find a film that anyone had made on it, and I called them and said, them being the people who organized this convention, I thought for sure they would never let me in. And to my shock and surprise, I mean, I literally had to get a crew within like a week. I had never made a documentary before, and got on the plane and went to Las Vegas and started shooting. And I really didn't have a complete idea of what the film was going to be when I started.
Yeah, that is what interests me about documentary filmmaking. We talked about it a lot on the show, how you can start with one notion and just the organic process of going through the production, that notion changes and matures. So I'm wondering, what was your goal when you set out to make this? And when you looked at the film and, you know, editing or throughout shooting, what did you find that your movie was actually about?
Well, when I started making the film, I always had this feeling. I mean, I named it Beer Wars before I ever started, so obviously I knew that there had to be conflict or else I couldn't call it that. And I also knew there was an evil empire because I had worked in the beer industry. And I'm sure you figured out who they are by watching the film. For those people who haven't, I'm sure everybody in America would know who they are. It's called Anheuser-Busch.
I knew you were going to say that.
and so I knew that. But what I didn't have were my protagonists. I needed heroes. And so I knew that it was going to be some sort of David and Goliath journey. There was also something happening at the time in the beer industry where the smaller players were just starting to make a dent in the big guy's business. And so I knew that there was something going on, and I really went to Las Vegas and started shooting the film thinking that I would just follow this story and see where it led me. And where it led me to, first of all, was finding two heroes, because I didn't just want to make a talking heads film. I mean, I personally don't love those kind of documentaries. I think they're really dull and boring. And I wanted that emotional connection that people would have with at least one, if not two. And I did end up with two, quote, heroes, two Davids who go out and fight Goliath.
Right.
When I started the film, I had no idea that Goliath would fight back. As people will see in the film, where actually Goliath, in this case again, is the evil empire's Anheuser-Busch, they actually come after both of the characters that I chose as the heroes in my film while I was shooting the film, which I guess was not maybe necessarily so good for them, but great for the film itself,
because
it brought in some conflict. So where I ended up was a David and Goliath story set in the beer industry. But, you know, when you make a documentary, having made narrative films before, the difference is that there is no script. And believe me that this is by far, out of all of the careers that I've had, and I've run some big companies, and I've done all kinds of interesting, difficult things, this by far wins the toughest thing I've ever done award, because you sit in the edit room and you have no idea of, like, how to move it along, how to finish it, how to craft it, and it was a real battle for me.
Well, you did a brilliant job. We're talking to Annette Baron. Her new film, Beer Wars, is released on DVD September 22nd. Let's talk about your two Davids, Sam and Rhonda, and the kinds of stumbling blocks that they've run into with these big corporations that we've mentioned. First of all, tell me about these two and what made them special enough to spotlight in your film.
Well, the first thing I did when I started making the film was start asking questions of the big guys, if you will, you know, the big players. And the big players in the beer industry, everybody knows who they are. It's Anheuser-Busch, Miller, and Coors. And when I started making the film, they were the big three. And since I made the film, actually at the very end of the film, we find out that they consolidate and get bought out. And, of course, you know, corporate America gets even bigger. But I the first character that I chose was a craft brewer.
Mm-hmm.
And these craft brewers are local brewers. They make beer in small batches. And there are over 1,500 of them in America today. And I wanted someone who not only symbolized who craft brewers were, but also had a story to tell. Because there's nothing more boring than just putting a character in who's not going anywhere. You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Joe. Well, Joe gets up in the morning. You know, I mean, that wasn't going to work for me. So when I met Sam Calagione, who is one of the heroes in the film, he owns Dogfish Head Craft Brewery out of Delaware, which I thought was fascinating. Because
Dogfish is one of my favorites, actually.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, they're great. I love that beer.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He started this cult beer out of, literally, Delaware, where you would never think that, you know, how could you have a successful brewery out of Delaware? It's in the middle of nowhere. And he just had a vision. And the reason I put him in the film is not only is Sam a great character, He's just like the guy next door. My thing about Sam is, and this is what I always hear, every woman wants to do him and every guy wants to be him.
So, wow, there you go.
He's just this just guy next door who is just a great guy, you know. And but what he does in the film is he actually, and obviously in real life, is he takes out a $9 million loan with his family, and they put everything on the line so he can expand his business. And so we watch that. That's kind of the dramatic tension, if you will, of his story.
Huge tension. That's
Yeah. Like, you know, he
gigantic. I mean,
that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Wow.
And it's also very his story, as well as Rhonda's, very inspiring.
Yeah.
I found the movie to be inspiring, and I was getting all riled up and upset because of the nature of the beast they had to attack to get their company going. It's very emotionally involving, your film.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's what took a long time to figure out. But that also, you know, a lot of the credit goes to the characters. I think Sam is a great character. I put the families in the film. They gave me great access. The other character is more Shakespearean, if you will. Rhonda Kellman was the co-founder of Boston Beer Company, the most successful craft beer that we all know about, called Sam Adams.
Yeah.
She was there when they launched it. She started the company with Jim Cook and really was one of the most successful women in the beer industry, which is very male-dominated, and yet decided to leave to try to go do it on her own. So her story was someone who had already, to me, achieved the pinnacle of success. I mean, you couldn't get bigger than her, and well-known within the industry, and then to go and try to do it all by herself, I thought was extremely brave. She started a new company and a new beer called Moonshot, which is beer with caffeine, which I found completely intriguing because not only can I not drink beer, but I can't drink caffeine. So
it's a lethal combination right
there. And, you know, people either love the idea or they think it's hideous. And
so you're going to be drunk and awake longer.
Well, you know, if you ask Rhonda, she'll say, well, people go to the bars. You know, if you say to her, like, where'd you come up with the idea? She'll say, well, I went to the bars and I saw people mixing Red Bull and vodka, right? So
sure.
Now, we were talking about that on a film set the other day. Okay. God, it's amazing how this all comes back to haunt me at the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so you either love that idea or hate the idea, but you've got to admit it gets people talking. And, you know, when you make a film, you're constantly looking for controversy and points of interest and things to keep people awake for 90 minutes.
Right.
And so I knew that beer, you know, I had no idea if she was going to succeed or not, which is part of the other challenge of making a documentary, right? You start something, but you have no idea how it's going to end because, there is no script.
Right.
And so Rhonda starts her company, and, you know, her journey is very different from Sam's in that her journey is much more typical of a startup entrepreneur in America, where pretty much when you start a business in this country, you're spending 90% of your time looking for money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, we see that journey, and we see her struggle, and we also see, you know, how tough it is. I mean, both she and Sam, like, have families, and yet this is their passion, and they're constantly torn between the two.
And how do the corporations, what are some of their tactics to kind of foil their road to success, Sam and Rhonda?
Well, you know, I don't think it's directed, obviously, just at Sam and Rhonda. They're just our
example. But people like them, those entrepreneurs.
Yes. Well, I mean, absolutely. Look, the beer industry is very unique in that, and as I explain in the film, there's something that doesn't exist in, like, cereal or other categories in the supermarket, for example, which is basically the shelf space. You know how you go to the store and there's a cooler?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that space is finite. You know, it can't grow. So pretty much if you create a new beer, just think about it, in order to get it into that cooler, if that space is fixed, something else has to come out. So if you imagine if you're Anheuser-Busch or if you're Miller or if you're Coors and you own most of that space, for a variety of reasons, and here comes entrepreneur A or entrepreneur B, and they want to get a new beer in, well, something has to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So every time something new launches, like Mike's Hard Lemonade, for example, you are unhappy because you don't want to lose any of your space. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right? It's like territory. You want to hold on to your territory at all costs. So what they do to hold on to that territory is, for example, when craft beer started to get big, or even when Rhonda started Moonshot, which is tiny. I think she was in like a dozen stores. They come out and they copy you, and they create a copycat. And because they have all the muscle, it's easier for them to get their beer on the shelf, their whatever new thing that they concoct, than it is for you to get yours.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So they're constantly coming up and trying to do what's called category killer. And a category killer is basically something pretty straightforward that tries to kill a category. So with Rhonda, they came up with a product called B to the E, which was their version of beer with caffeine. And, of course, with their muscle, marketing muscle, they're able to get it into all the stores in America while she's still struggling to get it into another dozen. They also come up with, in the craft world, what the craft brewers called faux craft beers, you know, fake craft beers. They come up with these great names and these great logos, and it looks so bucolic and handwritten, like, you know, like the guy down the street made it. Meanwhile, it's coming from, you know, one of the Budweiser plants. And they don't put their name on it. I mean, I think a great example of that is Blue Moon, which most people think is, you know, which actually was consumed in the White House just last week in the Beer Summit.
That's right.
By Sergeant Crowley. He had a Blue Moon. And I bet you money that he thinks that that beer either comes from Belgium or comes from some brewery down somewhere. He doesn't even know where. Meanwhile, the company that makes it is called the Blue Moon Brewing Company. And if you actually pay attention, it's made at the Molson Coors plant in Toronto.
Mm.
So Blue Moon is owned by Coors. It is not a small brewery at all, and yet everybody that you ask thinks that it is. And so that's what they do. They come in and they create beers that look. Now, is that illegal? Absolutely not. That's just capitalism and competition.
Right.
Is it fair? That's something for each person to ask themselves.
True.
It is interesting, though, because I think this is why some of these smaller beers are catching some traction here. The difference in ingredients, the difference in taste. When you're drinking these corporate beers, so-called corporate beers, what are you getting? Are you getting watered-down versions of what people would consider real beer?
Well, you know, I didn't cover taste in the film, partially because, you know, I don't know what it tastes like, and therefore it was hard for me to comment. But more importantly, because, you know, you can't. You know, there's something about when you make this kind of film, the people who drink craft beer and they call themselves beer geeks.
Right.
Oh, you know that word.
Yes, we do.
There's no Beer Geeks United. You might want to get that right away. But the beer geeks, you know, they think that, like, they call it Bud Miller Coors, all in one word, and they just say that it's all crap or it's all fizzy yellow beer. Well, you know, most Americans actually like that beer. What they like about it, A, is they love the commercials, because
yes.
If you watch the film, I think I hopefully do a convincing job of showing you that nobody really knows what they're drinking. They just think they do, because you think you're drinking a label, but, you know, all of these beers pretty much taste very similar. And more importantly, I think what happens is that the craft beer guys are, on the one hand, poo-pooing that beer. But the truth is people like those beers because either they've been conditioned to it or because they're lighter, and I'll tell you why they're lighter, and some people know this and some people don't, Budweiser, Bud Light, the Anheuser-Busch beers have rice in them. Did you know that? That's how they're so light.
I do since I saw your film, yes.
What do they have in them now?
Rice.
Oh, okay.
And Miller and Coors, and these are called adjuncts, and Miller and Coors actually use corn as an adjunct, and as we now know, corn is in everything. But who knew that it was in beer? And what these adjuncts do is they take the four basic ingredients of beer, which do we know what they are? Yeast, malt, hops, and water, and they actually make it lighter. So they make the taste lighter and they make the color lighter. That's what the rice or the corn does to the flavor of it. That is not, like, if you went to Germany, they have purity laws since the 15th century. You know, that totally contradicts all the purity laws. But that's what happened. And, you know, there's a history behind why it happened. But it pretty much happened after World War II, is that the beers just got lighter and lighter and lighter. So if you want an experience where you just want to get sloshed, well, then, you know, it doesn't get too heavy in your stomach, right, if you're drinking a light beer particularly. So you can drink a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with a craft beer, which are heavier, they're not meant to be, you know, drunk to get drunk. What you're supposed to do is actually enjoy them like you would a fine wine.
Right, right. I'm curious about your experience after you finished putting this film together and going through the festival circuit, which I would imagine that you've done, and the kind of reactions that you've received from the film.
I actually did not go through the festival circuit.
Oh, okay.
Remember The Evil Empire?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Do you know who sponsors almost every film festival that you know of?
Is it Bush?
Yes. Stella Artois, you've heard of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did not get into a lot of festivals. I've never been officially told that that's why. But when one of your largest sponsors is the antagonist in a film, I think as the programmer, you think twice about what you're going to program.
That's amazing, because you do say in the movie something like $800 million in advertising, $300 or $400 million in sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
You can't escape seeing a Budweiser ad or something associated
mm-hmm.
with Budweiser.
That's
and that
true.
Really does, as I said in the intro, it really does inform the tastes of the culture that advertising.
Yeah, it permeates everything. You know, I did an experiment because, again, I don't drink beer. I did this experiment for a week when I started making the film. How long can I go without seeing an Anheuser-Busch anything? So that is like turning the TV on and a commercial, going to the supermarket, walking down the street, driving, and pretty much every hour, you know, that I was conscious, there was some sort of Bud thing, because you go to a sporting event and there it is, you know, and
yeah.
It's just, it permeates, and you don't even think about it because they sponsor everything. I mean, I couldn't believe that they sponsor the presidential debates. I mean, it's just, they have found a way to reach all the way deep, and
mm-hmm.
what happens is, you know, I think with advertising in particular, it's become like wallpaper, so you don't really notice it until you're forced to notice it, like I was. And it was a real wake-up call for me. I mean, I was even in the beer industry, and I just had no idea how deep their tentacles were.
Yeah, and it does bring up an interesting point, too. And Jerry, you and I watch Bill Maher every week, and I know that
yes.
this is a big thing with him. With these corporations, when did it start not being satisfying enough to be profitable, to have a good year? When are you big enough? I mean, how much do you have to grow? And they try to crush everyone around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just very disheartening.
Well,
is this a change in the culture? I mean, what's shifted? What's changed for us?
Well, I think what happens is, I mean, look, you know, we all sell Wall Street, right? And we all know that greed is good, or so we heard back then.
But before that.
Right. But what I was going to say is, you know, here's the problem. And Sam, actually, who's one of the heroes in the film, says it a little bit in the movie when he talks about corporations. I mean, at the end of the day, and I don't know if either of you has seen The Corporation. Which
That's a great. That's the one Naomi Klein narrates too, right? She's interviewed.
She's in it, yeah. Yeah. You know, but in that film, I mean, they basically compare a corporation to a person, and we realize that it's this entity. And the problem is that when you have an entity that's totally about profit, it's really hard to focus on everything else. And so at some point, it's almost like, look, I mean, all corporations start with one or two people who have an idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, I mean, I'm a corporation. The Sam in the film is a Dogfish Head is a corporation. But there are corporations that are publicly traded, and there are corporations that are private. As long as you're private, you can decide how to run your business. You may be motivated only by profit. You may want to do profit sharing. You may care about your employees and want to share with them. You know, there are lots of ways that you can run it. It becomes a personal choice. When you have shareholders, and when everything is about those investor calls and analyst calls and pleasing the market and your share price, things change. And I'm not justifying it. It's just the reality. And yet, and I do hope that I show this in the film, you know, there's the way Anheuser-Busch has done business, and there's the way Miller and Coors have done business. And Miller and Coors, maybe because they're not as big, maybe because they're not number one, I don't know, But they're not trying to crush anyone. You know, even in my own experience in the beer industry, Miller and Coors never came after us with lawsuits. Anheuser-Busch, we were constantly fighting Anheuser-Busch over something. You know, I remember, like, we had come up with a tag for one of our products, and, you know, it was something like about your taste buds, and we were basically told that we couldn't use the term taste buds because Anheuser-Busch would sue us for it. You know, it's crazy. I mean, they just are so controlling.
Yeah, and it's interesting how Anheuser-Busch was sold to InBev. Is that a Japanese company? Where are they from?
Actually, InBev, it's way more complicated than that, but I'll try to simplify it. InBev is actually a Belgian, Brazilian company. It itself was an amalgamation of two companies, one from Belgium and one from Brazil, and together this new company called Anheuser-Busch InBev is not only the largest brewer in the world today, but is the fifth largest consumer products company.
Wow.
That is enormous.
Speaking of advertising, I do recall as soon as news broke that purchase had taken place, I started seeing ads for a new beer from them called something like American Ale. So people would have the impression that this is an all-American company.
Well, actually, that was a new beer they created. You know, there are two kinds of two kinds of beer. There's lagers, which, you know, most American beers are actually lagers, and ale. And so they had come out with this Budweiser American Ale before they got bought out, and then they had no choice but to release it as that. And,
oh, I see.
You know, until the beer summit last week, I think most Americans still had no idea that Anheuser-Busch was foreign-owned.
Wow.
Both Anheuser-Busch and Molson Coors are foreign-owned. So today the largest American-owned brewery is Boston Beer Company, which is less than 1% of all the beer in America. That's their market share, 1%.
Well, this is a fascinating movie, and I've been waiting to talk about beer on the show for a long time. So
Are you
drinking
any?
No, not at the moment. I feel the need to drink it when I watch football for some reason. I just can't avoid it. But I do appreciate you coming on so much.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed the time with you very much, and come back any time in the future.
Great. Well, call me any time.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Annette.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye. The movie is called Beer Wars. It releases on DVD September 22nd. You can reserve it on Amazon or Netflix, as one of our listeners in the chat room just did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great film, and we'll...
It sounds fascinating.
We'll bring it up again closer to release date. It deserves to be seen, definitely.
Cool.
Okay, we have a couple movies to talk about, and then we need to close off the show with our remembrances of our good friend Blake Snyder. We haven't talked about these two films yet, Jerry. Funny People.
Okay. What do you want me to say about Funny People?
Oh, I'm going to tell you what to say?
I thought like a talking point or something. Jason, I just want to say Jason made a derogatory comment about me in the chat room. He thought I was drunk. So I just wanted to... Okay, never mind. Obviously that went over really poorly, but...
Right. Well, it's hard to tell when you are or you aren't. I mean, it's... there's no telling from one show to
the
next.
I'm going for that Ben Stiller thing in Tropic Thunder, you know? Full on. Never mind. But let's see. Funny People. It wasn't that funny, and nor was it supposed
and
to
there
be.
And there weren't people in it.
No. It's, you know, I'm going to be very honest what I'm about to say here. I think parts of the film are actually very good. I think the film is, the best way I could describe the film in one sentence, it's the anti-Entourage. That's really to me what it is, where Entourage makes everything look very fun and easy and exciting to make it in Hollywood. It's like a fairy tale. Funny People has this inherent undercurrent of nastiness among its characters. And I think that's the right word to use, nastiness. I do think, though, there are times that the relationship between Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen is very genuine, and there is some sort of connection at times between the two of them. And then there's an honesty, too, where he says, do you work for me? You write jokes for me. That's it.
Right.
Nothing more. And I appreciate that honesty. Where I think the film falls apart is, you know, as we were talking earlier before we started the show, in the last hour with the relationship with the ex-flame, Leslie Mann, between Adam Sandler and her. It just doesn't, they don't know what to do with it, how to resolve it in any way.
Well, that's just it. And I think it's, I mean, he wanted to make a movie about a guy that has a death sentence, basically. He's dying of this disease. And typically movies like that always chart a course where that character begins to appreciate his life more. And
like the Michael Keaton one, My Life.
Yeah, he lives more in those last weeks or months than he ever has. And he wanted to turn that on his head and show a character that, when given that second chance, remains an asshole and completely blows it. Which I don't know that necessarily is conducive to the kind of movie he was going for, because it doesn't translate. It might be the one Judd Apatow movie that doesn't have effective kind of touchy-feely moments. You know, how he's great at combining the raunchy humor and pulling the heartstrings at the same time.
He did it very well in the first two films he directed. I mean, it was seamless. It was perfect. The transitions from drama to comedy were priceless. Here, it really... the movie sort of, no pun intended, it dies a couple of times. I mean, and the last half hour is not... There's no pulse, really.
I would say from the moment he finds out that he's not dying to the end of the movie, which is the last hour of the film, it meanders and loses its sense of direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of everything just kind of happens on screen, and there's no interest in the viewer. You know, I was entertained by it, but I was like, "Where's this going? I don't get it."
That's perfect. Where is it going? I think I couldn't have said it better myself. My thing is this, though, and Chris brought this up actually at the beginning of the summer preview. The first trailer really did give away the whole entire film.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed the second trailer, they trimmed that down, they changed that, but that trailer really gave away the whole movie. There was nothing, if you just saw that trailer, you would have figured out the whole movie.
Right.
And I do question, who made that trailer?
Well, in the end, in terms of this movie, I don't think it matters.
No, it doesn't. But
without that trailer, it still has the faults that it does.
Oh, it does. Oh, regardless. But I mean, even if I don't know, if you really weren't that into the director or Adam Sandler, you would have felt like, hey, I know what this movie's about. There's nothing,
right.
And it really is. You know, if you do see the trailer, I have to say, there's really not much more to get out of it than that. Which is sad.
I will say I liked all the performances.
Oh, I thought the performances were good. Don't mention his name, dude. Don't mention his name. Don't mention that actor's name.
Especially Jonah Hill.
Oh, God damn you.
he is funny, and I was telling you today, I look at him and I start laughing.
Yeah.
He's just got that bewildered, that sarcastic, bewildered look.
He does have that down. He really does.
Yeah, he's great. Speaking of funny people, as much as we have issues with it, I need to find this because I'd forgotten that I wanted to discuss it. I read a review of it, and I actually shared it with you on Thursday.
Okay.
From Rex Reed.
That's right.
Yes, Rex Reed is still working. He's still around.
I think he likes Oscar a lot.
Probably, because he is the most kind of venal, vicious critic I've ever read.
From what you read to me, wow.
Which means that he picks apart a movie, which is critics should do, but with no insight, and he's just merciless to the movies that he doesn't like, and there are even a lot of times when he makes it racial, but he always makes it personal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try to bring up the review because I do want to read a couple of passages for it.
Have you found it? Are you there or?
I don't know.
Okay, well, you know who else is very interesting in the movie? What I like about the movie? I want to say this because I mean, not so much his relationship with Jonah Hill, his roommates Jonah Hill and Jason Schwartzman, I find fascinating. That's actually what I find fascinating about the movie, those three relationships between the Seth Rogen character, his roommates, and Adam Sandler. And I think that's where it comes apart with this really, like, this antithesis of Entourage. It's just a fascinating look at life in Los Angeles and trying to make it in the entertainment business. I think that part of the film works very well.
That does work, and that's the first hour.
Yeah.
Okay, here's some of the jewels from Rex Reed's review. On Judd Apatow, he says, the most tasteless no talent since John Waters and the Farrelly Brothers. On Adam Sandler, he says, by contract, he should be legally prevented from ever appearing in a bathing suit. Like, what the hell is that?
What is that?
I don't know. On Jason Schwartzman, he says, if there's anyone more repulsive than Adam Sandler and Seth Rogen, it is Jason Schwartzman, who also provided a musical score that makes construction site jackhammers sound like Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Fawn, whatever. On Leslie Mann, he says, Mr. Apatow's spouse, who has appeared in both of the director's other moronic films, is a terrible actress who speaks through her sinus cavities and sounds like she has a speech impediment. In conclusion, he writes, if you object to public offenses of decency, smut that reduces the oxygen in the brain, or just plain lousy amateurish filmmaking, it's easy enough to avoid funny people like the swine flu. Unfortunately, if you're a film critic, the luxury of self-protection is not an option.
This is just pure nastiness, though. Like some of the characters in the film, this isn't even a review. This is just to insult everyone. It's like a dumbed-down version of Armand White. At least Armand White is very intelligent. I will give him that, and very articulate. This is just pure nastiness.
Yeah.
There's nothing redeeming. There's nothing really constructive about this at all.
Yeah, and that's par for the course for Rex Reed.
Yeah.
So, just to let you guys know, that's my Rex Reed rant. And I didn't even care for the movie either. But he was way off base, as he often is.
Yeah, that's beyond way off base. That's just like, let me ask you this. I know of his criticism, but was he before that, was he in the entertainment business, or did he try to break into the film business?
I think so. He had connections to Myra Breckinridge.
Okay, yeah, okay. So this is obviously a bitter, very bitter man. And it's
I don't know why he's bitter, but he's obviously bitter because it comes across in a lot of the reviews he writes that lack critical cohesion, and they just seem to be one insult after another that goes.
That's all it is.
Kind of transcends what criticism is supposed to be.
Yeah. You see, this is where it's different. Like what I like about where I was talking about this with a friend of the show, Paul Buscetti, the other day about how Roger Ebert went back and watched The Brown Bunny, a different cut of it, Vincent Gallo's film, you know, which he originally just hated. He just really destroyed it. And then he went back and watched a different cut of the film, and he actually, you know, liked it.
He was man enough to,
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to do that. And I think that really says a lot about Roger Ebert. It also says a lot about Vincent Gallo that he could, like, okay, I see, yeah, it's not the cut I showed. The cut you said was not a great... Let me give it another chance, give you the cut I had in mind.
I think Roger Ebert's a good antithesis of Rex Reed, because Roger Ebert, I find, walks into a movie wanting to love it.
Yes, he does.
And Rex Reed walks into a movie probably thinking, what kind of ingenious barbs can I throw at this? You know, I'll write my punchlines now before I see the
movie.
It
almost seems like that going to the actually having to watch the film is a nuisance to him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is never good. Why are you doing it in the first place, then, if it's a nuisance?
Whatever.
Yeah,
yeah okay, moving on from somebody that we hate to somebody we love. before we do, you saw Hump Day, and you saw, you talked about 500 Days of Summer.
Yes, I did. I could talk about 500 Days of Summer for the rest of the year. That's how much I like it.
Yeah, and I saw 500 Days of Summer, and I loved it, too. I thought it was a great movie, and as I said on a previous show, not ours, but Jason's show on Monday night, it really paints a great, vivid portrait, more than any movie I can remember, of the ecstasy and the agony of love.
Yeah. Oh, perfectly. Now, can we talk about this, a question I'm going to ask, and if you can't answer it, because you think I might give something away we won't talk about it, but I'm going to ask you this question because I want to know, I want to get your take, and I'll tell you what I think. Why do you think she's crying when they come out of watching The Graduate?
Probably because she feels that character has given up, has given in.
That's okay. That's a good answer. I was thinking because going on that kind of same thought that he's not, she wouldn't want to be, she hasn't found that person that she wants to do that to be with, and it's not him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
okay.
That's what I was thinking along those lines. And like you said, there's another moment that relates to that with his whole philosophy. With that involves her later on towards the end of the film, that is just so bittersweet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a good way to describe the movie, bittersweet, but it's just done so well, and the performances by the both of them are exquisite. I can't get over how good they are together on screen.
Yeah.
I can't get enough of, I mean, it's just like, was blown away by this.
Yeah, it was very good. My favorite section of it was... He falls in love with her. The moment he does, he starts dancing in the street, and then
uh-huh.
It becomes an overblown thing with a marching band and everything.
Yeah, that was great.
And then it cuts to months later, and the elevator door opens to his work, and he's just freaking miserable.
Yeah.
So that's
perfect.
And one little two-minute sequence, that's the movie. That's the theme of the movie right there. And that's the feeling it gives you. It makes those feelings intense and vivid.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. It's a really great film, and it's. I know that it's trying to position itself as this year's Juno, as so many movies do, because it is a little self conscious in its style.
It is not as much as Juno, but can I say I do like Juno? I know a lot. It's hip to say you don't like Juno, and the more I think about Juno, I was like, you know, I like that movie. You know, that's a good movie. You know, all the hype and everything aside now, we're a couple years removed from it. I like Juno.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I know a lot of people, it's hip to say, oh, it's an overrated movie. I like it, you know? It has some great moments in it.
All right.
Okay.
We welcomed a very special guest on the show twice in our history. The first time was... November of 2007, so this is going back in the first 7-8 months of our existence, and again in May of 2008.
Yeah, right before Indiana Jones.
Summer Day. Movies, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great show, too.
Yeah, this guest's name was Blake Snyder, and he will always remain one of the great teachers and writers of the art of screencraft and storytelling, and a very personable, infectious, energetic, welcoming, warm, and open guy who welcomed everyone with an interest in storytelling to come to him for advice, to talk about their projects, to share their enthusiasm. He was like a sponge for that kind of thing.
He was wonderful.
Yeah, and we had a great time speaking with him on both occasions, and we were in contact with him. Jerry, I know you had several contacts with
mm-hmm.
him on
Facebook.
Facebook. Yeah, and he actually wrote me on Facebook a couple of weeks ago and said that he had a new book out at the end of the year and he'd love to come back on. His books were called the Save the Cat series, and basically the two books that he wrote in that series that are out now, and I think the third one will come out later. We'll talk about it then. Deconstruct the screenplay form, deconstruct genre in a very unique and insightful way. I've read so many screenwriting books, and I said to him, this is the one that makes the most sense to me. This is the one that is written in the most conversational manner, and I get it, and I'm enthused about it. I'm excited about it, the prospect of writing after I read this book. It's one of the best-selling screenwriting books, this 1-2 combo, and you can find links to those books on Amazon at the top of our page. He passed away yesterday morning. We were just told today. I think he was 51, 52 of a heart attack. Far too soon.
way too soon.
Yeah, a great man, loved by so many, and moved, inspired so many people, like thousands and thousands of people around the world. If you go to his Facebook page, if you go to his blog that he kept up at blakesnyder.com and read those condolences, you'll see that he meant a lot to a lot of people, and he really helped so many people and inspired such a passion in people for, you know, I know it's discouraging, but do it because you love it. Don't do it because you want to be the next Spielberg or whatever. Just do it for the love of it, which is the most valuable advice I think you can give anyone in the arts. So I put together, we put together a kind of a collection of our two conversations with him here on the show. And what I want you to pay attention to are those qualities that we've mentioned, that he was open-hearted, so warm, and so knowledgeable. But above else, he loved movies.
He really did.
Yeah, he was a guy in the business because he loved movies, and he never, ever lost that. So here is Blake Snyder, and then we'll continue for a couple of minutes after this highlight clip.
He is a highly accomplished screenwriter who's made millions writing films for giants like Disney and Steven Spielberg. Widely known as one of Hollywood's most successful spec screenwriters, Mr. Snyder first committed his years of hard-earned expertise to the pages of his 2005 book, Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need. Six printings later, that book has become the primary teaching tool at some of the most prestigious university screenwriting programs in the country. This month, Mr. Snyder delivers a sequel of sorts that's every bit as entertaining, enlightening, and engaging as his last effort. In Save the Cat Goes to the Movies, The Screenwriter's Guide to Every Story Ever Told, Mr. Snyder outlines a variety of genre types and applies his foolproof structural breakdowns to 50 classic films from the last 30 years. Mr. Snyder himself describes the book as a universal key to unlock every successful movie ever made. And boy, does he deliver on that promise. This incredibly fun and insightful book will deepen everyone's appreciation and understanding of great cinematic storytelling, from the newbie screenwriter to the most enthusiastic film fan. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Blake Snyder. Mr. Snyder, are you with us?
Jamie, thank you very much.
Your book is fantastic. I adored it. It's written very in a very conversational, fun, yet informative tone. I loved it. And I just want to share with you, I was watching Alien, the original Alien, on cable with my girlfriend the other day. She hadn't seen it. And I shouted out, oh, that's a M-I-T-H, that's a monster in the house. And she had no idea what I was talking about. So we'll fill her in during this interview. But first of all, tell me a little bit about your background. Tell me how your career started.
Well, I'm third generation, actually, of film business. My father's uncle was an RKO publicist. Mm. My dad was a producer. He a children's TV producer for shows like Roger Ramjet. I don't know if you know that show. Cartoon in the 60s is sort of a cult classic.
Yeah.
And a show called Big Blue Marble in the 70s.
Big Blue Marble, I remember.
Oh, cool.
I remember watching that like every Saturday, I believe, on NBC.
Yeah, it was a nice show about kids around the world. It was an Emmy Award-winning show, and so I grew up in the business. I mean, I did grow up in the business and learned a lot of valuable lessons from my dad. I got my SAG card doing voices for his cartoons when I was
eight.
Oh, wow. So, you know, I learned about the business a lot from him, including sort of the ups and downs of it, as your previous guest was speaking of. There's this intersection between, you know, art and commerce, and you know, some of your best creative ideas, you know, take the longest to get made, and you know, having a little bit of patience was a good lesson too. And then when I got out of school, I went immediately. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to write screenplays, and I started writing on spec, as it's called. So got very lucky, sold a lot of scripts over the course of my career. I sold one to Steven Spielberg for called Nuclear Family. And it was, you know, talk about a couple of great conversations. I sat across the table from, you know, Steven Spielberg as he talked about his love of movies. And, you know, the lesson I got from him was he loved what he was doing, and he could name every movie, name what people were wearing in certain times, you know. And
that just, you can feel that enthusiasm in every one of his movies too.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I love about your show, and I love about this pursuit, which is I love storytelling. I love storytelling. Love movies, and I love finding, you know, patterns in what makes a good story. So
let's talk about your storytelling techniques and some of those patterns as you've described them in your books. First of all, save the cat. That expression. What does that concept of save the cat mean?
Well, there have been a lot of really good screenwriting books out there, and I've learned from the masters. You know, Sid Field was, when I was coming up, it was the book that everyone read. His book called Screenplay, which is just the classic. And also from Robert McKee, lots and lots of people. You know, I've learned from the best. But even, you know, the ones that are out there seemed to me to be academic.
Right.
And what I had never seen really was sort of an inside baseball screenwriting book that sort of talks the way me and my screenwriter pals talk. And that's where Save the Cat came from. Save the Cat is just, you know, me and my buddies hanging around Jerry's Deli and after the meeting at the studio saying, you know, trying to fix a certain script. And, you know, where's the Save the Cat scene? The Save the Cat scene is when we meet the hero of a movie for the first time. And the hero does something nice, like, you know, save a cat.
Mm-hmm.
It
right.
makes us like him. It makes us want to go along with him. And it's a key element in getting the story going right. You know, many times we hear a variation of that note from the studio people saying, you know, why, I don't like this guy. I don't like this hero. Why don't I like this hero? And very often we had failed to put in that scene.
That moment of redemption.
Well, yeah, where we go, oh, this is an okay guy. I want to see where, I want to root for him.
Right.
Right.
The classic example is, you know, Al Pacino in a movie called Sea of Love. He's a cop.
You've mentioned my idol there.
Yeah, I mean, you just sealed the deal. I mean.
Oh, good. Yeah, he's terrific. And that movie in particular was sort of a comeback vehicle for him at the time, believe it or not. I mean, and everything had to be right. And part of that was liking the character he played. And right up front, Sea of Love, he's a cop, and they have a sting operation where they bring, you know, outstanding warrants in by pretending that they're going to have breakfast with the Yankees. Well, they bust all the guys, and then here comes this one guy late to this sting operation, and he's brought his kid with him. Well, Al Pacino sees his father with his son. The dad just wants his kid to meet the Yankees. And, you know, he checks the warrants, makes sure this guy isn't like a major felon, and then he says, you know, take a walk. We're going to let you go. Flashes his badge. The guy realizes the favor he just got.
Right.
And walks away. And, you know, the great line going out was, you know, Al Pacino says, catch you later.
Absolutely.
He's not a total fool. but we like him. And I don't know about you, but I'm going with this guy now.
Absolutely.
I like this guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the only reason for that scene, and that's the Save the Cat scene.
So your first book, Save the Cat, the last book on screenwriting you'll ever need. What motivated you to write a sequel to the last book on screenwriting?
I got sort of I thought really that this I had said everything I wanted to say in the first book, and writing that really came out of, you know, writers asking me advice, and I kind of wrote it all out in a form that I thought was easy to read, and yet there was still some unfinished business. The second book really gets more into genre, and as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Monster in the House is sort of my slangy term for a type of movie that we all know. And, you know, I have 10 of those different genres. Well, I mentioned them in the first book. I sort of, in passing, sort of talked about what I thought were the sort of the 10 types of movies Hollywood makes and audiences like.
Yeah.
And then I realized, you know, we really have to go further here and explain this. So the last 2 years have really been a wonderful journey for me. I've watched, you know, hundreds of films to pick the 50 that I thought were best examples of what
yeah.
different genres were. And I learned so much. I got to say, there were moments where I'd be watching a set of films and go, oh, I can't believe there's this character that appears in every one.
Uh-huh.
And you know, for a screenwriter, it's not just about, you know, I don't want to copy, but I want to know the essence. I want to know what makes these stories work.
If you could kind of illustrate for our listeners, when you're talking about the similarities between these movies as represented in these different genres, let's take The Monster in the House. I think this first dawned on you. You had a conversation where someone said to you that I think it was Jaws and Alien are the same movie. Was that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I was a young writer, 20-year-old guy, and this was my initiation into storytelling. My friend Jim Hagen, we would go on to write that script that we sold to Nuclear Family, but at the time we were just young writers, and he said that to me. Did you know that Alien and Jaws are the same movie? Well, to me, this was mind-blowing, you know. One movie is about a shark, you know, run amok on the beaches of Amity. The other is about, you know, a space monster, spaceship. How are these two movies similar? Well, he went on to point out the similarities. We called it a Monster in the House movie, and
mm-hmm.
they have three important characteristics. There is a monster, you know, intent on eating the cast. There is an enclosed space into which this monster is let loose. And the most important element of this was there's a sin. Sin of greed is what lets the monster loose in Amity. It's the same sin that lets the monster loose on the spaceship Nostromo
yeah.
in Alien. And uncovering that societal sin is sort of the transformational thing that happens in these stories. Well, Monster House Sin, you see the story goes all the way back to the Minotaur and the Maze.
Mm.
Great monster, half man, half bull, great house.
Yeah.
This scary maze. And the sin in that story is incest, societal incest.
Yeah.
You keep seeing this movie again and again. Saw, you know, you can think of the house that Carrie always is enclosed in. You can think of The Shining, a haunted house movie. Monster, house, sin, monster, house, sin. It just keeps repeating again and again. And, you know, our job as screenwriters, our job as storytellers is to make it fresh. You take these elements. That, you know, if you thought The Minotaur and the Maze was the last horror movie you'd ever need to watch, you haven't seen Bruce the Shark yet. You know? I have to say, it gives me chills to talk about storytelling. It gives me chills to get into, you know, what makes a good story work.
Mm.
You know, the themes of that your previous guest was talking about, you know, have to be worked, and they have to be fit into a story in a certain way. So the study of that and how that works is just never ending, and that's why I love what I'm doing now. These books have been a remarkable transformation for me. I keep selling scripts. I sold a horror movie last year. As a matter of fact, it's like my 13th spec script.
Oh, congratulations!
Oh yeah, thanks. But the most fun I'm having now is talking to other writers and helping them with their scripts and getting some of these points across. I think it's a very important part of communication, and telling a good story, you know, can be mastered and used in any situation, you know, a speech you give or commercial for something, anything. There's
yeah.
We tell stories.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And they can purchase your book on Amazon.com and also communicate with you and purchase your book through your own personal website.
Yes, and also in both the books, I give out my personal email address, and I welcome people to, you know, pitch me their movie idea, ask advice of anything. You know, I'm happy to help them navigate these waters, and whether they want to make an independent film or a doc or, you know, break into the studio system in some sense, happy to help.
Tonight we're talking about summer movies. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the show Mr. Blake Snyder. Now let's talk about summer movies.
Yeah.
As a film fan, do you get giddy when summertime approaches, just like all of us?
I call it the summer tingle. You know, when I first see those posters, I was talking about it last couple weeks ago. Indy, May 22nd. You know, the kind of the hair on the back of my neck goes up, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, that dark cavern, you know, the movie theater, my popcorn scrunching down in my seat and saying, you know, here we go. I just, you know, ever since, you know, I went and saw my first movie, the idea of being in that theater, it's so exciting. And I'm hoping that this summer is a great one for Hollywood.
I hope so.
But, you know, the Indiana Jones is a character. I mean, he's kind of an old-fashioned hero now, you know, the kind of the swashbuckler. But as of late, a lot of these movies that we've seen through comic books or what have you, they've kind of been the anti-heroes. And I'm looking at a couple of the other big films out this summer. I think you could certainly argue that The Dark Knight fits that mold. But a movie like Hancock. I'm reading advanced reviews of this, and it's saying that they're having a hard time finding the right tone. How far is too far when you present kind of the anti-hero aspect of your lead character? When do you start to lose an audience?
Well, again, it may not be obvious, but this is a type of movie that is a superhero movie, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a cape and can fly through space. The superhero is a story about a special person who has to deal with being special. You know, we send Hercules down from Mount Olympus to help us little Lilliputians down here, and he never gets a thanks for any of it.
Right.
He can't date. He can't tell anybody who he is. He just has to do his mission, and that's every superhero story. You know, one of the better ones was Spider-Man 2, which is clearly demonstrates the problem for Peter Parker, which is, you know, can I be a human being, or do I have to be this guy who saves everybody all the time? And that template we've seen a lot. So it looks like Hancock, what they're doing is sort of taking it to the next level. We're going to make him a guy with a drinking problem. We're going to make him a guy who's really not dealing with being special very well. And, you know, who knows how that's going to turn out. It's kind of dark comedy in a lot of ways.
Right, yeah.
I'm getting the sense that, like all these good stories, there'll be a redemption at the end where he'll find, you know, a new meaning for himself.
Oh, it has to. But upon first look at that trailer, I thought, now that's a hit. I mean, you can just read the log line of that film, and you know that, and put Will Smith's name on it, that's a hit.
Yeah, that's a hit.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
He's the summer go-to guy, and I guess how long has it been? Every July 4th he has a movie
every
come
July
out.
4th, but now it seems like every Christmas, too. The Pursuit of Happiness. And while I don't think it's a great movie, I Am Legend, I think his performance in I Am Legend is the glue that holds that film together. I think he is excellent. I mean, if it's possible to like a performance but not the finished product, I have to say he is superb.
I think so, too. And it also has one of the great Save the Cat moments of all time.
Tell us.
Yeah, what would that be, please?
Will Smith actually saves the cat. I mean, the first time you meet him in I Am Legend, he's hunting a deer for his dinner, and a lion comes onto the scene, and he's just about to shoot the lion and stops when his little cub wanders onto the scene. Well, he doesn't want to make that cub an orphan, and when he doesn't shoot, we go, I like this guy.
Yeah.
And that is classic Save the Cat. That is literally Save the Cat. And this is the moment where I'm in the movie theater and I yelled out, Save the Cat. So I encourage anyone who's in the movie theater this summer who sees a Save the Cat moment to please yell out.
Yell it out. Let's start a movement here. Go on to Batman for a little bit. I know that when Batman Begins came out, Chris Nolan's film, everybody was raving because it was such a departure from the last couple they felt that were getting too kind of cartoonish in tone. What do you think, from a screenwriter standpoint, made the difference in that film, Batman Begins, from the previous few that came out?
Well, it's too blunt to say it's darker. That's clear, and it seems to be more more realistic in a strange way. It's the genesis story for Bruce Wayne, and we have to tell it again. I mean, this is constantly our job as screenwriters, is to make it fresh for this audience, for today's audience. So, you know, my vision of Batman may be Michael Keaton, and you know, my father's vision of Batman might be Adam West. But this generation's vision of Batman is something new, and they have to sort of start that up again. So both in Batman, the first one, and this Iron Man that came out this summer, these are both sort of Genesis stories that set the franchise in motion, and that's tricky. That's tricky. I think they did a fabulous job, and I can't wait to see this. And this will probably be the best one yet. I mean,
yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah,
I can't see how it can be. It looks amazing. Knowing all that you do about screenwriting and structure and beats, when you go to the theater, is it difficult to be surprised for you?
It's funny. I was writing about this the other day in one of my columns, and watching movies, Iron Man, watching Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and realizing here are these wildly different types of movies, and yet they both hit the beats. They all have this exact same story structure. And someone wrote me and said, is this bad? Does this mean that there's a there's a formula, and the formula keeps being churned out? And no. The truth of it is you can apply these beats to every story you tell, and it's just a matter of applying your own creativity to it. So I love to see how people, tell a story. I'm now more fascinated with that than ever. And, yes, there are many times where I'm sitting there going, oh, that was effective, instead of, getting into the moment. but I think I've heard that about comedians too, which like you, when a comedian hears a good joke, he doesn't laugh. He just goes, yeah, good, good.
That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah, good. Good thinking. But I still love the experience of going to the movies. Again, this is my, the summer tingle, is coming. So that'll be good.
Yeah, this is going to be a great season for movies.
Yeah.
And a great audience movies out this summer, of course. But I think this summer something feels special about this summer over the previous few for me. But I want to end with this because we paid lip service to it last time you were on. Do you find any filmmakers that are trying to break this three-act structure, or do you think that's possible? Do you think a movie can work outside of the typical three-act structure?
Oh, sure. And again, it goes back to what we've been talking about all along, which is, tell me a story about a hero who transforms. Whatever that process is, that's what we're here, that's what we want to see. The beats of the story, the structure of the story can change. You look at movies that slice up time, like Pulp Fiction,
right.
that use all kinds of different storytelling techniques, Atonement. It was all a dream,
Right.
I'm just telling you a story. You see how it works when you break up the structure. But the point of it is the structure is the same regardless. If you're going to tell me a story, you're going to tell me one that resonates with us. And that is just a simple story about a guy or, a set of heroes who transforms in the course of this adventure. And in some sense is touched by something divine. I insist that last moment, what really makes Star Wars work is, use the Force, Luke.
Yeah.
It's that part where we give up everything we know that's human and we turn to something that's beyond our
leap, yeah,
imagination, and that's what we're looking for because we want that in our own lives. So that's what works, and it will work forever.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And Mr. Blake, thank you so much for being with us tonight. 45 minutes just passed by in a snap of the fingers.
Wow.
Yeah, thank you very much, Blake.
We love you on the show, and you're welcome back anytime in the future. Check out his books, the Save the Cat series. And check out his website, too, blakesnyder.com. He has a blog that he keeps up and all the news you need from him and appearances and so forth. Thank you so much, Blake.
Thank you.
Please come back sometime in the near future.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it. Love your show. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
One of the
you know, one of the best guests that we've ever had. Someone who was enthusiastic about movies, but also enthusiastic about the craft, and also enthusiastic about helping people
mm-hmm.
improve that craft and really make it in the business. And that's why when you told me earlier this evening what had happened and he had passed away, I was really devastated because he was a class act and a very rare person in this business.
Yeah,
and
you said it earlier today that, you know, he was a good friend to so many that wanted to pursue a career in an unfriendly business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'll be missed.
And go to his website at blakesnyder.com if you've... And we received emails from people that said that they bought the book after hearing our interview. So if you've been moved by Blake Snyder or you want to make mention of his contribution or his appearances on the show, do so at blakesnyder.com. Leave a message there on that blog, and that will be greatly appreciated.
Yeah.
If we get plenty of input from the Movie Geeks family, that would be great.
Yes.
All right, so that does it for tonight. We appreciate everybody tuning in. And
thank you.
And we'll see you guys back here Wednesday. Blake Snyder's dead at age 51, and he will be missed. We'll miss you, our friend.
We'll miss you, Blake. Thank you.